From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, it's Theater Day. Let's put on a show. We talk to playwright David Hare, who currently has two productions on Broadway, Amy's View, starring Oscar winner Judi Dench, and Via Dolorosa, Hare's own one-man performance about his trip to Israel. Also, we meet the composer and star of Hedwig and the Angry Inch, the off-Broadway hit about a transsexual glam rock star who looks for love in all the wrong places. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead corrects some common misconceptions about Duke Ellington. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest David Hare is right now the most prominent British playwright of his generation. He's had no fewer than four works on Broadway over the past 12 months. These include The Judas Kiss, starring Liam Neeson as Oscar Wilde, and The Blue Room, which caused a kerfuffle over star Nicole Kidman's bit of onstage nudity. Right now on Broadway is Amy's View, starring the recent Oscar winner Judi Dench, and Via Dolorosa, a monologue in which Hare makes his own Broadway debut as a performer. He tells of visits he made to Israel talking to Israelis and Palestinians about their profound quarrel. Here's an excerpt from a recording of his performance. He's exploring the religious sites of Jerusalem and has just emerged from the Christian Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
It's a relief. I'd say a relief. To come out of the dark and stroll down to the big open plaza where you find the Wailing Wall. Strangely impressive, tall, uncrowded, the bit where the Jews are allowed. For towering above them, at the very top of the arrangement, is the most coveted spot in the universe of faith. What the Jews call Temple Mount, but what to the Arabs who occupy it is known as the Haram al-Sharif. And at its center, the saffron-yellow, golden dome of the rock. I have felt, since I arrived, that Jerusalem doesn't need my admiration. Enough people are obsessed with it already. The truth is, I look at it and think how beautiful it must have been when it was a small town. Myself, I would like Jerusalem more if it were less important. But even I, inside the Arab sanctuary, taking in the cleanest, most oxygenated, sun-dazzled air you ever breathed, looking across to the Mount of Olives, yield to the splendour of the place and realise, oh, I see how provoking it is to own beauty, to own the most breathtaking space of them all.
David Hare had at first been commissioned to write a play about the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, but once he got there, he found the present-day situation much more compelling and that his preconceptions about this part of the world were altered.
Well, I think that, you know, I come from a country where nobody's very sure what they believe, and in the materialistic West, it is very startling to go from a place where nobody has to work out what they believe to go to countries, both Arab and Jewish, where people have to work out exactly what they believe in order to decide how they are to behave. So it was the contrast between countries where, if you like, we skim along the surface, not necessarily needing to work out what we truly think, with a country where you really do have to work out what you think. But more than that, like most Westerners, I had imagined that the argument was between Israelis and Arabs. Mm-hmm. Far from it, I found that the divisions within Israelis and the divisions within Arab society were in a way more profound and of more universal interest than the divisions between Israelis and Arabs. And it's that division, both between the secular and religious views in Israel and the idealistic and the corrupt sides of the Palestinian character, that I wanted to bring out and say this argument is more complicated than it looks.
How long after you arrived there did you realize that this was the case and that you were not going to write a more conventional play, that you were going to act more as almost as a reporter?
I think within a few days it became plain to me that the life in the Middle East is so vivid that the idea of recreating it on a London stage with the inadequate resources which you would have were completely ridiculous. Whatever you ended up with would not be authentic. As soon as you thought, oh, we're going to have to play out scenes, you thought, well, we'll have to get some Jewish actors from North London, and then to play the Palestinians we'll have to get, if we're lucky, one Egyptian, one Lebanese, one light-skinned Pakistani, people who in no way resemble Palestinians. And then we'll have to make the basic act of pretense, which is the theatre, and it will smell of falsity before you even begin.
here in America, so much creative work in all media is obsessed with the idea of balance and fairness and the need to give both sides in any argument equal weight. And I wondered if during the writing of Via Dolorosa, how much did its structure depend on your wanting to present that kind of both sides of the argument?
Well, I didn't want to write a polemical piece. You know, a friend of mine who is an American Jewish playwright is currently writing a play in which he will be arguing, and indeed it's also a monologue, not for himself, but for an actress, in which he will be arguing that Israel is a historical mistake, that in other words, the Jews should never have gone there, that they should have stayed assimilated, that the diaspora, in other words, was a good thing, and that Israel should now be written off as a historical failure. And I said to him, you, as a Jew, are entitled to make sweeping historical judgments like that. But as a visitor to the country and as a visitor to Palestine, and as someone who, if you like, has nothing invested in the area, it's valueless for me to make those kind of sweeping judgments. What I can do is bring the perspective of non-faith to a place of faith. And what I can also do is act as honest reporter. I was very moved by a letter I got from somebody who told me that they were about to give a talk, a lecture, and they were very, very nervous. And they were reassured by the American architect, Philip Johnson, who happened to be standing next to them. And Johnson said, there's no need to be nervous before a talk because the audience will not be listening to what you're saying. They will be deciding whether you're an honest man or not. And I think that is true. I think that's the basic transaction that goes on when one human being listens to another. And so I wanted to purify that to a 95-minute monologue where the audience could decide whether they trusted me or not as I told the story of how it seemed to me.
Mm-hmm. I guess one thing that it occurs to me in this, in watching it, is that you are quoting someone like, for instance, Keith Lawrence, describing him as a British citizen who finds Tel Aviv sexy. And you're kind of imposing your own interpretation of Keith Lawrence and what he's doing for the Israelis in Israel. You know, how do you come to those kinds of decisions on how you characterize someone in the piece?
Well, it's a moral question. There's an ethical dimension to this. It seems to me that you can't meet people and then go and represent them on the stage without being sure about what you're doing. And so my responsibility is, if you like, a journalistic responsibility. For that reason, I ran people's scenes by them. In other words, I sent them the pages that would represent their point of view.
Oh, could you give me an example of someone that you had sent the pages to?
There are very few people I didn't send the pages to.
Really?
Of course, because if you are going to represent somebody on the stage, then you cannot rely on your shorthand and your scribbled notes and the way you fashion their dialogue and say, now here is, as it were, Iran Baniel, and then not send the pages to Iran Baniel and say, this is how you're going to be. A lot of the people in the show have seen the show. Iran Baniel, for instance, has seen the show, and he's thrilled with the way he's represented.
And who is that? Please tell us, our audience.
Iran Baniel is an Israeli theatre director who early on is quoted from an extreme secular position as saying that he doesn't understand what all this fuss about the land is about because he thinks that it is un-Jewish to want to expand into places that don't belong to you. He's of that school in Israel that believes that the beginning of Israel's troubles was in 1967 during the Six-Day War when it seized land which does not properly belong to it. Now, he has, you know, not only has he authenticated his pages which were sent to him, he came to see the show and was entirely happy with the way that he was represented. And there is no question, I absolutely agree with you, that it is a moral business. You can't put people on the stage and travesty them.
I read that one night in the London production of Via Dolorosa, there was a kind of organized protest that some Jewish members of the audience tried to disrupt your performance by coughing loudly, and that the playwright Harold Pinter, who was also in the audience, hissed, shut up to them. What was your impression on stage of what was going on at that point?
Well, it can get quite lively up there. Here in New York, individual lines are being booed, clapped, hissed. Some people keep up a relentless running commentary until they're told to shut up by other members of the audience. This is very, very controversial material, and I would regard it as a strange state of affairs if this wasn't going on. I'm happy to say that nobody has organised to disrupt the show, which I think would be a disastrously silly thing to do and an unnecessary thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the right of people to express where they dissent from what a character is saying or what I am saying, or indeed to approve, often we get a little war. You know, we get people who are pro-settlers and anti-settlers, and they're really fighting not me, but each other, by the way that they respond to individual lines.
Are there passages in the monologue that in particular consistently get a reaction from the audience?
Oh, sure. When a militant settler says that the Six-Day War was the greatest victory in Jewish history, then some people will applaud at that point. When a secular Jew says that the religious Orthodox smile and rob the country blind, again, that can get an extreme reaction from either side.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are places regularly in the evening where I know I may be up in for a bit of a bumpy ride. It seems to me a good thing. And in fact, in New York, the first couple of performances, people seem to be looking at it as if it were just a play. And then on Saturday night, the first Saturday night, somebody looked out of the stage door and they said, "It's half an hour since the play ended and people are still arguing in the street." And I thought, great, that is exactly what I came to Broadway to do.
My guest is the playwright David Hare. He's also performing his monologue Via Della Rosa on Broadway. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Hare, whose latest play to be presented on Broadway is Amy's View. I'd like to back up a little bit chronologically and go to the Blue Room, which recently closed on Broadway. There was a big media to-do here in America in a way that New York straight plays almost never are. I sometimes think that almost all of the hubbub can be ascribed to exactly one quote from one British reviewer of the play who came away after seeing Nicole Kidman's performance and described it as a jolt of pure theatrical Viagra. This is not exactly theater criticism worthy of George Bernard Shaw, but I wonder if you were appalled by that because it would obscure your serious intentions, or perhaps secretly pleased because it was such good publicity.
Well, the hilarious thing is that the critic who used that phrase, Charles Spencer, has just been made British Critic of the Year. And I saw him in New York the other day, and he said to me, "It is entirely because I wrote that phrase." And somehow that phrase went round the world.
It certainly
did.
He
said, "I have the Blue Room to thank for the fact that I've got a pot," you know. I think something went on in London, which was that people became incredibly excited sexually by the material. And so, yeah, to put it unkindly, a lot of white middle-aged theatre critics became extremely excited by the presence of Nicole Kidman. To put it kindly, they did find the play extremely erotic. It's all very well. I deeply resent the word hype when it's used about the Blue Room. Hype is something which is basically used to sell something which is worthless, whereas the Blue Room became a phenomenon of word of mouth. In New York, the hoopla appeared more to be about fame than about sex. In other words, people seemed overexcited at the prospect that not only would Nicole Kidman be on the stage, but that they might catch a glimpse of Tom Cruise running in and out of the theatre. And so you could crudely, as a racial stereotype, say that if it's sex that still excites the English, it's fame which excites the Americans.
Is there ever a point when having a big star you mars your work to the extent that it can't be heard clearly?
I didn't think so. I thought she gave a completely wonderful performance. I mean, Nicole Kidman came to the project. It was Sam Mendes' idea, not my idea, to update La Ronde and to set it in the present day. And I was delighted to do it because I wanted to write something for Nicole, who I think is a wonderful actress and an underestimated actress. When she arrived, she had very, very little theatre experience. She hadn't done a play for 12 years. I have never, ever watched anybody learn so much so quickly. You could say The Blue Room was Nicole Kidman's theatrical drama school, and there wasn't a challenge that was put before her that she didn't rise to. And so I had nothing but admiration for her, and I didn't think she did anything but decorate the role. The hoopla was not her fault, you know.
Yeah. On the other hand, by contrast, Judi Dench is a very experienced stage actress. In Amy's view, she is the central presence, an aging actress who's finding it harder to get good roles, who also has longstanding issues, as they say in the current pop psychology cant, with her daughter, Amy. Amy has married a young man whose Dench's character despises. He's first a film critic, and then as the years go by in the play, he becomes a very successful TV host and a film director, a kind of cross between, I don't know, Quentin Tarantino and Melvin Bragg or something, I suppose. When I saw the play, some of the biggest...
Perish the thought.
Yeah, exactly. What a mutant. When I saw the play, some of the biggest audience reaction came from Dench's speeches about the pointlessness of critics and the vapidness of TV. I wondered, how much of those feelings do you share with her character?
Well, I was very interested to see the play. I saw it for the first time, at a preview in New York, for the first time in some time. And of course, I was interested to see whether the argument about the media would have the same bitterness in America that it has in England. In England, high culture, traditional cultural forms, namely poetry, classical music, and the theatre, have been under really persistent ideological attack, mostly from Murdoch newspapers. In other words, there's been a feeling in the Murdoch press that culture itself is part of an establishment conspiracy to foist onto people what they don't want. In other words, that high culture is something essentially anti-democratic. And, well, what I love here in America is that the people who value high culture really value it. And, you know, if you meet American poets, then in a way, the question of whether they have an audience or not is not terribly important to them, mm-hmm. because they accept that very few people are going to listen to them. When John Ashbery gives a poetry reading in New York, 70 or 80 people come. It doesn't bother John Ashbery because poetry is something which he accepts will be a minority interest. Mm-hmm. What he wants to do is add to something called poetry, so that he doesn't have the sense of guilt which we have in the theatre. Those of us who work in the serious theatre all the time are haunted by the fact that we're not attracting as big an audience as we feel we ought to. Composers who work in serious music, because they work in a form where there is such a thing as popular music, if you go to a performance of modern music, it's rather sad. There is a feeling of this ought to excite and interest a lot more people, but it doesn't. But in America, what I love is that because high culture is so marginalized, then the people who love it feel free to love it. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful thing.
I think it's only comparatively recently that most Americans have become aware of Judi Dench's work. Yes, I've read that you said she always claims that she doesn't know what your plays are about, even as she's doing them night after night. Is that true?
She not only doesn't know what they're about, she generally doesn't read them. She generally accepts a role not on the script, but she usually asks you to tell her the story. And she foolishly got herself into the play Mother Courage because she said it sounded such a wonderful story. When she played Mother Courage, she found she didn't like it. And at the end of the read-through, she said, I don't like this play as much now that I've actually heard it as I did when it was described to me.
Well, I read... three weeks into the original production of your play, Amy's View, she asked to quit. Is that true?
She did, absolutely. But that was because she couldn't learn the lines. And the reason she couldn't learn the lines is because she's never had to learn lines. She's what we in England call a very quick study. She can look at a page of dialogue and know it. Until recently, in the last few years, she's had to work to learn lines. And so when she was having trouble learning the lines, I said to her, Judy, what you are experiencing is no more than what most actors have experienced for the whole of their lives. But because you were had the best memory of any actor I ever met. You think you've got Alzheimer's. You haven't got Alzheimer's. You're just experiencing what all other human beings have experienced for the last 60 years. And she was satisfied with that explanation.
Do you go to the theater regularly when you're at home to keep up with things?
Certainly do.
You do. And have you seen anything you liked lately? Is there a new generation of playwrights that whose work you look forward to?
I certainly look forward to the work of Patrick Marber. And, you know, I was lucky enough to see Closer in the Cottesloe when it first opened. And Patrick Marber is a fabulously talented young playwright. He is part of a whole generation who are rediscovering the theatre. As you said earlier, you know, maybe people in their 30s and 40s now are, if you like, the missing generation, the people who were brought up with the television set in the corner and knew no alternative. They're the people who fell in love with video. The love affair with video is, I think, you know, maybe coming to an end. And because of that, you're suddenly getting, at the Royal Court Theatre, you're getting producible plays sent through the post to the artistic director there, who can put them straight on. This is something that hasn't happened for 30 years. And it doesn't really matter whether I or writers of my age like or dislike these plays. What's happening again, which is the most important thing that can happen in the theatre, is the young are speaking to the young again. And whenever you have a young John Osborne who speaks to a young audience, or a young Harold Pinter who speaks to a young audience, that's when the theatre's vital. The theatre's dead when it's only voices of my age.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you speaking.
Not at all. Thank you.
David Hare, who currently has two hit shows on Broadway. I'm Ken Tucker, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Serta, maker of the Serta Perfect Sleeper mattress, helping generations of Americans to sleep since 1931. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Kevin Whitehead corrects some common misconceptions about Duke Ellington. Also, an off-Broadway hit about a transsexual glam rock star. We meet composer Stephen Trask and actor Michael Cerveris from Hedwig and the Angry Inch. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker. Hedwig and the Angry Inch is a long-running off-Broadway musical about a failed rock singer who happens to be a German transsexual who spent a good part of his or her life in a Kansas trailer park. The show is a concert given by Hedwig and his band, the Angry Inch. It has a lot of good, loud, glam rock-style songs and a lot of bitterly hilarious between-song patter from Hedwig. Unlike other rock musicals, the songs are performed on stage by a real-life rock band, Cheater. John Cameron Mitchell wrote the book for the show and was its original star. My guests are Michael Cerveris, who currently plays Hedwig, and composer-lyricist Stephen Trask, who wrote the music. Let's listen to a bit of the song that opens the show from the Hedwig cast album on RCA Records featuring John Cameron Mitchell.
Ladies and gentlemen, whether you like it or not, Hedwig!
Don't you know me? I'm a new Berlin Wall, baby. Try and tear me down. I was born on the other side, but a town ripped in two. I'm headed over the Great Divide. Now I'm coming for you. And I'm gazing at the stairs. They try and tear me down. You want me, baby?
It seems to me when I went and saw the show that everything about Hedwig is divided. He's from East Berlin, and some of the songs talk about the fall of the Berlin Wall. He comes to America as the boyfriend of an American GI who makes him promise to get a sex change operation, which he does. It's a very bad, botched job, which is the source of the phrase angry inch. But then he's dumped, and he lives in this depressing trailer camp where he takes care of this young boy he falls in love with, Tommy, who goes on to be a big, huge rock star. And so Hedwig is very divided over any happiness he might have over Tommy's success. Yet Hedwig tells us this in this hilarious stream of consciousness patter between songs. And I wonder, Michael, do you feel that you have to sell that kind of material, almost like a stand-up comic, 1 minute, and then make sure that the audience appreciates the pain and poignance in this character the next minute?
It's not really a sort of on and off, back and forth thing like that so much. It's sort of both elements are present all the time, and it's sometimes the more tragic elements are kind of rise up, and at other times you do feel like you're doing a stand-up routine, but at that moment that's what Hedwig is doing. So and I had always thought that stand-up was probably one of the most terrifying things that you could possibly be asked to do, but I discovered that if you wear an outrageous dress and wig and a lot of glitter, that you can actually get away with just about anything.
Well, let's play here a segment from the show, the cut called Angry Inch.
To be free, one must give up a little part of oneself.
Stephen, it seems like the trick to pull off in a show like this is to write very good songs about a very bad rock singer, you know? I mean, Hedwig, I think, describes himself in my notes. I wrote down that he said he's a slip of a girly boy who becomes an internationally ignored song stylist. I mean, is it difficult to write good songs about a bad rock performer?
Well, I always thought Hedwig was a good performer who was ignored, like myself. Uh-huh. And I guess what was, you know, it was hard for me developing this huge range of songs. Actually, it was more the band is really supposed to be kind of bad, and developing this huge range of difficult songs and trying to like convince people that this band of Eastern European renegades with no money could somehow pull off this huge, you know, variety of pieces. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever write a song and say, no, that's too good. Hedwig and his band couldn't come up with something like that.
No.
No.
I never.
No. I think the showstopper in this score is Wicked Little Town. Why don't we hear a little bit of that, and then I'd like to ask you something about that. Let's hear Wicked Little Town.
Forgive me, for I did not know. I was just a boy, and you were so much more than any god could ever.
That's Wicked Little Town from the soundtrack album to Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Stephen, can you tell me something about writing that song? It seems to come at a point in the show when you really need to build to a climax. Was it conceived as that kind of showstopper?
This version of Wicked Little Town is a reprise of an earlier version, which had existed for pretty much the whole time that we were doing Hedwig. Peter Askin, the director of the play, who did a lot of dramaturgy on the project, suggested that at the end of the play, as part of the closer, Hedwig would sort of transform into Tommy Gnosis, her alter ego, the successful rock star, and that he would have to sing to her some song that would bring together all her storylines and draw them to a conclusion. And we decided that it would be a reprise of Wicked Little Town. And it took me really about 11 months to come up with those lyrics. Not the whole time, but really trying to think, what does Hedwig need to have said to her at this moment? What are all the things that Hedwig needs to have said? And no one really told me what they were. So I kind of, for those 11 months, had Hedwig on a sort of couch in my mind talking about her issues and tried to think of what I would say to Hedwig to resolve these issues. And so the main thing is that this search for the other half is a red herring, you know, that there's no sort of magical, mystical other half who's out there waiting for you that you can somehow find, who will make you into a whole person and bring you happiness ever after, that that you need to be whole within in and of yourself. Mm-hmm. And that within Hedwig, there were actually these beautiful things that she wasn't recognizing, like her ability to take an ugly situation, as if it were like a found object, and turn it into art, the same way that a lot of artists in the 60s and a lot of folk artists were doing. And I actually read, I spent a lot of time reading art books. So I was sort of combining a lot of the philosophies of the surrealists who were dealing with, surrealism was kind of a response to the World War I and what seemed to be sort of the death of rationalism, and an artistic response to a world that had seemed to be built upon logic and yet fell apart entirely. And that somehow Hedwig had reached this point too, where she was following this philosophy that she was sure worked, you know, and it just led to her utter destruction. Mm-hmm. And so in the two songs, Exquisite Corpse and the reprise of Wicked Little Town, I tried to utilize the philosophies of surrealism and move Hedwig on to the next stage where she can reject the philosophies that had failed her and find some way of creating beauty and recreating her life.
My guests are Stephen Trask, who wrote the songs for the musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and the show's current Hedwig, Michael Cerveris. Back in a flash, this is Fresh Air. I'm talking with two of the people behind the off-Broadway hit Hedwig and the Angry Inch, composer Stephen Trask and current star Michael Cerveris. Michael, what are the audiences like for this show? Do they get the sense of what they're in for the degree of drama that's also mixed in with the comedy?
I don't think so. I think it's really hard to prepare people for what they're going to see before they come. One of the things that I love about the show is the way it begins as just a really exciting, funny glam drag rock show, and and you think it's going to be just, you know, this really campy, fun evening. But pretty early on, pretty much once you get to Origin of Love, which is the second song of the show, you suddenly realize that there's going to be a lot more to this. Mm-hmm. And but by that point, your defenses are sort of down. You're, you know, you've sort of wandered innocently into this world, and now you're there. And the way that it manages to kind of entice you in and then sort of hit you with the deeper
aspects
of the story.
You pretty much batter down the defenses. I mean, you're out there in the audience by the song Sugar Daddy. You're out there right among the people in this very small theater.
Climbing, in fact, on top of them.
Well, but, the night I attended, I must admit to you, I was your sugar daddy the night. I was sitting alone in the theater. All of a sudden, I heard a voice say, "Ah, I see my sugar daddy for tonight." The next thing I knew, you were on top of the chair. And thanks.
I'm glad. Thank you for the dance.
Anytime.
But yeah, it's interesting watching the audiences. I mean, we get all kinds of people now. I mean, we still have the club kid downtown people coming, which are sort of have been the core audience from the beginning. But we've now started to branch out and reach out to the more traditional theater-going audiences, which is a terrific thing. And it's nice to not just be preaching to the converted all the time, but to, you know, be bringing people in who might not, had they totally known what it was, might not have decided to come down. But when they get themselves there and are experiencing it, they find that they love it. And, you know, that they never would have imagined loving a musical about a, you know, transsexual German rock singer, but they find that, you know, it actually has a lot to say to them about, you know, their lives and the lives of people that they know. So that's a really exciting thing, to look out at this bizarre cross-section of New York and America and present this, you know, fractured sort of vision and have everybody almost without fail walk away really having been moved and totally entertained and loving it. And we still have enough people walk out on occasion that we know we're doing something right.
Have you had walkouts?
Yeah. You know, from time to time, people who either find it, you know, offensive for whatever reason, and God knows there are plenty of reasons, or just don't feel that it's their cup of tea, but surprisingly few given the subject matter.
Yeah, because I was wondering what the reaction is when you've taken Hedwig out into the mainstream world. I mean, I know that you've performed on the Rosie O'Donnell Show and David Letterman. What kind of reaction do you get when Hedwig is taken out of that theater element?
Well, that's more Stevens.
There was a lot of heat generated on the Rosie O'Donnell in her chat room. Some people were very offended because her show is supposed to be rated G, and they wrote in, "How dare you put that thing on my television? You know, that monstrosity, that drag queen, that prostitute. She looked like a hooker. My daughter was home from school that day."
Who was saying things like this?
You know, people, the sort of people that have enough time on their hands to watch Rosie O'Donnell and write an email. Uh-huh. And then people responded to them, and so there's this ongoing debate. Well, I think it's you know, it's culturally enlightening, and then someone would write in and say, you know, my daughter was home from school, and we were so offended we had to turn to the Game Show Network. And David Letterman was great. He didn't quite know how to respond, but the audience loved it. The funniest experience we had outside of a nightclub or a theater. Was very early on when John and I were developing this. We performed on a patio on Fire Island as a fundraiser, and it was a very high-priced fundraiser. So Sandy Gallen and David Geffen and all these, you know, the Velvet Mafia, I think they call them, were all around, and they did not know what to make of us. It was broad daylight on the beach, and John was going around asking people to sign his body, and he had these magic markers. And
did they do it?
David
Geffen's autograph on his abdomen.
David Geffen, Terrence McNally, a lot of, you know, the whole gang.
The Radio City gig was pretty funny too. Actually, opening for on New Year's Eve this past year, we opened for Boy George and Culture Club at Radio City Music Hall.
Oh, well,
for an audience of people who, some of whom had seen the show or at least knew what we were about, but but I think most of whom really were just coming to have an 80s flashback sort of evening, and so we kind of shook them up a little bit.
Well, Boy George certainly seems as if he could be a possible understudy for Hedwig at certain points.
He told us that he was the one who did the wigs around there, but otherwise he was really friendly.
Very gracious.
Yeah.
Stephen Trask and Michael Cerveris from Hedwig and the Angry Inch. The show's co-creator, John Cameron Mitchell, is currently adapting it for the movies. Let's go out with Mitchell singing a quiet song from the new cast album, The Origin of Love.
When the earth was still flat, and clouds made of fire, and mountains stretched up to the sky, sometimes higher. Folks roamed the earth like big rolling kegs. They had two sets of arms, they had two sets of legs, they had two faces peering out of one giant head, so they could watch all around them as they talked while they read, and they never knew nothing of love. It was before all the origin of love. And there was three sexes then, one that looked like two men glued up back to back. They called the children of the sun, and similar in shape and girth was the children of the earth. They looked like two girls rolled up in one. And the children of the moon was like a fork stuck on a spoon. There was part sun, part earth, part daughter, part sun.
Coming up, we correct some common misconceptions about Duke Ellington. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says jazz has its own version of Y2K. He calls it the century bug and says its symptoms are requests to briefly summarize the significance of 100 years of Gershwin or jazz, or in this case, Duke Ellington, born April 29, 1899 in Washington, D.C. Kevin says most everyone knows something about Ellington, but some of the things they know aren't necessarily true. He'll try to set us straight on a few of them.
Coco, 1940. Like a lot of Ellington, the blues all dressed up and ready to go. Duke Ellington was a lot of people. Pianist, composer, songwriter, band leader, motivator, diplomat, ladies' man, emblem of the race. Trying to sum up who he was in a few minutes is like trying to explain the appeal of baseball or chocolate. You can't really separate Ellington, the artist, from the public figure. His elegant work and dignified bearing each speak to his confidence in the depths and riches of an African-American heritage. Because he's been subject to so much scrutiny, his career is pretty well understood, but there are some common misconceptions you should be aware of, if only to contradict talky jazz buffs at parties. First off, man's name is Duke, not the Duke. Think about it. Whose name has the in it? Hey, the Duke, pass the salt. John Wayne, same deal, by the way. Duke. Johnny Hodges. In 1932, Duke Ellington wrote a song called It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing, a catchy tune whose catchy title helped make swing the familiar term for buoyant jazz rhythm. But for Duke, that title was never an 11th commandment, exclusionary rule, or restrictive covenant. Ellington himself sometimes made music where swing was obviously not the point, at which time a critic or two would advise him to stick to dance music. For Ellington, swing rhythm is like garlic. Terrific stuff, but you don't have to put it in absolutely everything.
Often we'll feel weary, but he knows our every care. Go to him in secret. He will lead your every breath. Up from dawn till sunset, man work hard.
Come Sunday, Ellington's most enduring piece of religious music, sung by Mahalia Jackson with Duke's Orchestra in 1958. That hymn comes from Black, Brown, and Beige, the first and in many ways best of Ellington's long suites for his orchestra. When it debuted in 1943, some writers said jazz musicians shouldn't write concert music. Duke's position, basically, was, then please don't call me a jazz musician. For sure, a lot of singers Ellington hired scored low on the swing meter, despite worthy exceptions like Ivy Anderson and Betty Roche. But even fans overlook one of the best, a relaxed swinger who spent 23 years with the band. But then singing was just a sideline for trumpeter and violinist Ray Nance.
I get sentimental when you hold me tight. Just squeeze me, but please don't tease me. Missing you since you went away, singing the blues away each day, counting the nights and waiting for you. I'm in the mood to let you know, I never knew I loved you so. Please say you love me too. When I get this feeling, I'm in ecstasy. So squeeze me, but please don't tease me.
Some folks may tell you, maybe because they read it in an Ellington biography, that the man wasn't much of a piano player. Yeah. We'll let Duke's fingers do the talking on this issue in a minute. The one big cliche we didn't tackle today is Ellington always wrote for the individuals in his band. That's sort of true, but it calls for some explanation as it gets to the heart of what makes his music extraordinary. So we'll devote our next segment to that issue. Meanwhile, the proper way to celebrate Duke's big birthday is to spin your Ellington records. And if you're running low, most anything from the early 1940s is a safe bet. Remember, listening to his music is way more fun than hearing somebody talk about it.
King Kevin Whitehead, not the King, is the author of New Dutch Swing. We'll hear part two of his Ellington review tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Ken Tucker.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And Little Brown & Company, publisher of White Oleander, a novel by Janet Fitch, now available in hardcover at bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Michael Ondaatje, author of The English Patient. He has a new collection of poetry. And we meet Mark Linkous, the man behind the rock band Sparkle Horse. I'm Ken Tucker. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Trask from the off-Broadway rock musical Hedwig and the Angry.